The next case is 96-1436, Toledo Bar Association versus Nicholas Batt. Justice Douglas has recused himself from this case, and we're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Douglas, Judge Gary Tyack, who's a judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 10th District. Welcome.
Judge Tyack,
welcome back.
Thank you, Chief.
Mr. Kettlewell.
Chief Justice, please support the Charles Kettlewell here on behalf of Mr. Batt. I do want to clarify one matter that may have been mistaken in the news case on this. I did represent Mr. Batt in early stages of this for a good year. I was Lewis counsel to the financial difficulties that I had. There are two or three things that I think need to be addressed. One is the bar has drawn to my attention that they feel that there may have been a misleading statement in the restitution that was paid by Mr. Batt to the village of Holland. To the extent that this court or any other person thinks that there was misrepresentation, I want to set the record clear. This case had stipulations entered into the bar a number of years ago. Mr. Batt admitted to a number of violations and committed the conduct in the one place for opinion. On the restitution issue, part of those stipulations, Mr. Batt was entitled to put forward a statement of litigation. And on page 18 of that, he makes this statement. Judge McDonald awarded restitution in the amount of $11,860 for Holland and $6,720 for Oregon. My malpractice carrier and I settled the claim by the village, which included the $11,860. The lease is attached to Exhibit G. Now, that's the village of Holland. He goes on to say, I have paid the $6,720 for the Lewis County Health Probation Fund. That's not in dispute. The question that's been raised by the bar is whether that statement was misleading. So this court will understand there was litigation, civil litigation filed by the village of Collins. It included two or three allegations of malpractice, and it included the key billing issues that were in part of the criminal case that led to this conviction in 1993. His insurance carrier, Oleg, took the position they did not have responsibility for the fee billing issue. But nevertheless, their attorney and the letters and documents substantiate that all four issues were part of the settlement to be negotiated. And the release was attached to Exhibit H and shows that the matter was ultimately settled for a total value of $35,000. There is no question of what that $11,860 was a part of that civil claim. There's no question of what it was included in the settlement. If a member of this court has the question that Mr. Batt specifically instructed Oakley or himself to pay that $11,860, no, nothing. I've not been able to find anything that says that the $35,000, this part was designated for this part. That's just not the way cases are resolved. In any event, there certainly was no intention to mislead anyone. And as the later brief points out, the evidence shows Mr. Batt was released from probation by the sentencing judge in the case in June of 1996. I would also point out that Mr. Batt was going through bankruptcy at that time to meet a village, filed any exemption or fraud to exempt any claim they might have from fees from the bankruptcy matter, where they were aware that such exemptions could be applied to those fights wouldn't be. They were not applied, they were discharged. My next point is that in the opinion in this case, and this has a long history, perhaps the longest history of any case I've seen in the past 19 years, there were a number of motions filed early on in the case, attempts to disqualify the bar, have the matter moved. As Mr. Cuffs pointed out in the panel's opinion, this case went on for a great deal of time, and Mr. Batt ultimately reached the agreement to sell the bar with the stipulations that constitute the bulk of the record in this case. They then agreed that there would be a hearing, and that hearing was attended by Mr. Cuffs 2010, but he did participate in the state, I'm sorry, the decision. And I think it's important, this court note, that Mr. Cups, who did most of the questioning at that short hearing that occurred, Mr. Cups took the position that it should be an indefinite suspension. And that's all we're here about. The bar recommended an indefinite suspension. Mr. Matt agrees he should be indefinite suspended. Mr. Cups said, based upon three things, the bar's recommendations. Additionally, he had observed him and he said that the criminal in the disciplinary cases that had the, and I'm quoting, dramatically impacted respondent's perceptions, possibly, and if the possibility exists, the respondent will be successful in his efforts to rehabilitate himself. After seeing this man, after seeing Mr. Bat, and hearing him, in addition to reading the cold record, which was very, very bad, that was Mr. Cuff's conclusion. The board concluded it should be a disbarment, but they gave three reasons. They said there are four felony convictions. This court knows that the fact that there are four felony convictions in and of itself is not a felony disbarment. They said that there were 16 disciplinary rules violated, but when you look at these counts, you see, for example, in count four, the environmental case, in the very abusive language that was used by Mr. Bass in those proceedings, it was wrong. But those acts over about a month and a half period, primarily concentrating in a month period, although they did extend, if you look at the 15,000 pages, they did extend for longer than that during the environmental hearings. It's those acts, but there's a number of DRs that those same acts can be brought into. We really have a multiplicity of charging for those. And then the last thing the board said was that the ethical and criminal matters got publicity. Publicity is not what decides what the district is going to be. And in this case, great deal of publicity was given this matter by the Toledo Bar, Toledo Bar Rag, and their gridiron show, where Nick Bat became the target of a number of accusations about these matters while the disciplinary case was pending.
Well, could they mean, I agree with you, Mr. Caldwell, that the publicity itself isn't a factor that we should determine because nobody has much control over what kind of publicity we get. But isn't the point that his conduct was the kind of conduct that, given publicity, people are abhorrent among in lawyers? I mean, if you take any of the conduct, the lying and the misfiling and his conduct with Judge Duskin, isn't the point that this was not conduct that was out of the sight of anyone who forms opinions about our profession, but that his conduct brought with it considerable public scrutiny, or at least public information or knowledge?
It became the subject of a great deal of publicity. In this case, Mr. Pratt practiced law for 17 years, and he went through a two-year period, 88-89, which is the focus of where these matters occur. Mr. Bat, his statement on litigation says, I just became consumed. He states in there, not as a justification, but he states, I now, on the benefit of counseling, in hindsight, can look back and say, I became absolutely consumed. On behalf of the Village of Holland, I took on I attended these hearings, I tried to keep my practice going, and nothing was more important to me than winning. Mr. Bat has learned, that's what I think Mr. Cups observed, Mr. Bat learned. He learned a great deal. He lost his marriage, he lost his practice, he lost his license, he lost his reputation, and he lost his money. He's been through all of those things. And he is on the road back to recovery. Now, there was a great deal of publicity because this was a small village taking on environmental hazards, waste matters. And in fact, on the issue of did all this indicate that there was something prejudicial to the administration of justice, I think the fact that the panel found against him after all those hours and months, and then the total board found in his favor and reversed the panel, has some meaning. Mr. Bat was wrong. No one knows better than he that he was wrong in the comments he made before. No one knows better than he that he was wrong in not keeping the good billing records that he kept before this period of time, and that he continued to practice until 1993 with no further problems. He kept records afterwards, he kept records before. But he went out during that period of time. And yes, there was bad publicity, and he sincerely regressed that.
Mr. Caldwell, is there any way that Mr. Bat could have some sort of limited license that would keep him out of the litigation process and out of the contested hearing process, and limit him more to the kind of real estate matters and things where he wouldn't be as likely to encounter the emotional stresses and strains, such as in buyer safe or similar matters.
Well, let me answer it two ways. If this board has best structure really anything they want, if not, as a matter of habit, said, you can come back to practice one way, but not another, although there have been a couple of instances where somebody has said, well, I'll just do governmental work where I'm supervised and whatnot. But the second thing is this. Mr. Bat practiced for 17 years, and in the 88-89 period, he did engage in gross conduct. It was wrong. He has already been out for 3 years. He's going to be out. But as a benefit of the counseling...
May I interject something here? During, you're indicating that you just had this aberration for 2 years. During that period of time, were there any other problems going on in his life in addition to the stress, etc.?
Well, if I have my dates correct, I think he got married just before the environmental case went on. He had health problems while it was going on, where his weight shot way up, his blood pressure shot way up. He was hospitalized a period of time after that. I'm sorry, Justice, I forgot that he was hospitalized a period during then. I know he had to stay at home for a period of time. Marital problems became very severe. They had a child born for him in this period. And one of his statements was made in the record. I just put this case above everything else. And he did it. An aberration for 2 years, a long aberration. Usually when I use the word aberration, I'm talking about one isolated instance here, maybe two at the most. This was a period of time ago where he became consumed. I've got to win these. I'm out here fighting this cause. And coming back to Mr. Pack's point, I think what a reinstatement hearing would show, and that he would clearly be able to demonstrate at that point in time, is that he wouldn't need that type of restriction on him in the future. I think it would show that he is now has that composure, the ability to maintain himself in any area of practice. And if he can't show that at the reinstatement proceeding, then this court and the board likely will not let him back in. He made major mistakes. I want to point out two other things. One is the word disbarment comes up in the relator's brief. I think the relators were upset with Mr. Batman's litigation, said, I'd like to have credit for time served. He wasn't meaning to welch on his agreement to get an indefinite suspension. He was arguing for his life, and he took the strongest position that he could. But they point out in their brief that ADA sanctions for certain misconduct would result in disbarment. But the word disbarment used in those ADA sanctions is the same as our indefinite suspension. It is not our permanent disbarment. It is not. And they also mentioned Judge McDonald used the phrase disbar. This court is well aware that lawyers in general would use the word disbarment with any disciplinary proceeding. Judge McDonald is aware, he's alive and active, he's aware of what's going on in these cases. And I submit there was no misleading to anyone in those instances. An indefinite suspension in this case will mean Mr. Bat is out for 5 years before he can be applied. He's been out for 3 months. He'll be out for 2 more after this court's decision. And all he is asking is the chance to come back before a panel and convince them of the issues that concern you. What happened to this man? Has he got it under control now? Is he now somebody we can again say is competent?
How would that be shown, demonstrated to us in view of his very bad conduct in different way, different types of conduct? How could that be shown to us in a way that in 2 years we could feel comfortable in knowing that he's not going to go in and call some judge bought this job and you're, you know, that sort of thing? I mean, that.
Your Honor, I think the fact that he continued to practice under a great deal of continued stress. I mean, this stress didn't disappear in 1990. It went up. Criminal charges, dismissal charges, civil charges, foreclosures, bankruptcy. He didn't engage in that conduct again.
Well, but we don't know. He hasn't been in the practice.
He continued to practice from 1993.
Well, okay, but I mean during the...
Right.
All right.
And what
period he's out.
Show, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay.
And what he would then show is that in the periods of time since then, what he's done with his life, what he's done in community services, in the same way each lawyer has to show rehabilitation. And what have they done good? He's got his real estate license back now. What is he doing in that area? How is he accounting for himself? He's got custody of his child. These are the issues that they're, these and a number of others that he would bring up. And that is all that he asked, is that he be enforced to have opportunity to come back.
Is there counseling involved here? Psychological? Not ongoing now. Is that right?
It's my understanding he's not under any steady counsel at this point. I mean, we're a number of years beyond the original matters. He does see counselors from time to time. In fact, he just drives and courses in counseling himself. But he's not continuing with that. He is providing for himself and for his son. I deserve it.
Thank you, Mr. Kettlewell. Mr. McKay.
Hey, please support. My name is John McKay. I'm the attorney representing the Gator Bar Association. Full counsel is Mark Liberal. Our other full counsel, Charlie Strusker, Joe Woodberg, will not be here today. I will represent you all. There is the issue before the court, I think, breaks down to the record of disagreement with the sanction. There is no disagreement over the stipulation. We reaffirm the stipulation. However, there is a very strong disagreement over the characterization of Mr. Bass' conduct and over events that have occurred subsequent to the stipulation. And we believe this has a direct bearing on how this case should be decided. We very strongly believe that these are not aberrations in the respondent's conduct. This was his stock in trade from the day he graduated from law school. What you saw before the Ohio Waste Facilities Board is not aberrant behavior. In the mitigation hearing, because of things that have occurred to us in other mitigation hearings where there's been a stipulation, the relator took pains to present letters from presenting the other point of view. These letters were by people who were closely associated with Mr. Bath, who worked with him through periods of time and who had extensive knowledge of how he practiced law. Those letters are real libel. Mr. Bath engaged in this conduct regardless of the stress, which I guess goes to Judge Hayek's question. So technically, what are we here for?
Those letters, I assume, are in the record, and the board obviously had access to it.
The Board of Commissioners has recommended this firm. The stipulation is one of the indefinite suspension. The parties disagree on when the suspension should commence. We believe, based strongly on the conduct that has occurred subsequent to the stipulation, that the respondent has not shown enough of a rehabilitation to justify retroactive effect on the suspension. He needs a strong state that he needs to do more before he can be considered to practice. If he's off probation, he can be applied to practice for a The reason for this is the violations are serious and aggravated. They're laid out in a lengthy stipulation, very bold, very dry, very technical language. If you take away the counsel's veneer on things, you will see that underneath the respondent himself does not understand what's happening. He does not appreciate the injury that caused, does not appreciate right and wrong, and he's not truly remorseful. He is only sorry that he can't practice law. I want to be clear, we're here not disagreeing with the stipulation. We here vigorously argue that there should be a severe sanction. If we're presenting a vigorous argument based on our past experiences, the last time I was here before the court on a grievance matter, I also faced a situation where the Board of Commissioners recommended a sanction for serving as a constituent. I got soundly chastised by one of the justices who is now retired for not being more vigorous in presenting a view of counter to the respondent. I'm also mindful of the instructions I've gotten from the hearing panel that I've done before in the court. The job of the hearing panel of the court is not only to judge the respondent, but to judge the relator, to make sure that the process, the relator is not given away the sore or been too harsh. And in order to facilitate that process, we have to put forth the facts before the court and let the court make its independent decision. And also argue the contrary. Finally, that's the experience. We had these stipulations for mitigating hearing panels, and we rested on the stipulation and said nothing. We believe in the stipulation. We have found that hearing panels assume to be, we believe, a little bit of mitigating evidence, and have invariably licensed the sanctions. We even had one case where stipulated facts were ignored. And so, for that reason, we are being very rigorous to be sure that we get the sanctions that we need to deserve.
Well, let me understand it. Mr. Killewell was talking about he would, if we indefinitely suspend Mr. Batt, that he will have been out for 5 years before he can reapply.
That's
and you're arguing that we shouldn't give credit. We should
That's
indefinitely
correct.
Suspend but not give credit for
That's
time already out. So you're where he is, aren't you? The same position?
He gets at least 2 more years of suspension.
Yeah. Well, I thought Mr. Kettlewell was, I mean, he didn't argue, but he was sort of assuming that, I thought, that...
In the past, they have sought retroactivity in what you suspension.
Yeah, but... Okay.
But even so, you still have the right to independent judges. Now, Mr. Kettlewell has summarized the violations Yes, why the stipulation? Why did we stipulate the indefinite suspension with such a horrible fact pattern? You've got to remember, this was respondent's stock in trade. When he finally agreed to the stipulation, we were flabbergasted. Before that, we were coming from the disbarment. So when he agreed to this detailed stipulation, we thought, hey, maybe there's a chance of rehabilitation. And we're not out
But you stated that this was Mr. Batt's stock in trade from the time he graduated from law school. Now, what would cause you to think that Mr. Batt is going to be different if he is indefinitely suspended and then readmitted in 2 years?
In his career up to the date of stipulation, he never, ever admitted wrongly of any kind, let alone to the extent of
Well, maybe he admitted it to save his license.
That's possible.
I mean, he obviously knew that he was probably facing a disbarment with his conduct, I would guess. He didn't have to talk to a lawyer to know that. I mean, I guess I'm really wondering why on this record, why the Toledo Bar would still be urging an indefinite suspension. I mean, you can certainly, but I'm really curious, too, as to why, having seen all you've seen and heard all you've heard and now revealing to us that this is not an aberration, why do you think the bar is served by this person continuing to be a lawyer? Or could be.
Could be.
Yeah,
could be.
Right.
I think the answer is could be, number one. And number two, at the setting of time when you made the decision, this was something new. We thought that this was a positive step forward. And I think that although we think he's taken steps back since then, so with a strong message from this court, he is not necessarily, he should be foreclosed for law in the future. And I agree.
Let me ask the same question from you. Mr. Batt has apparently a fair amount of expertise in real estate matters and things of that nature. Is there any way that something could be fashioned that would allow him to do office-type lawyering, but keep him out of the high-stress and what may be even damaging for him, high-stress litigation type of lawyering?
Well, the liquor permit violation, and it was not a litigation matter.
Well, I understand, but also it was a matter about which she knew precious little, and I would probably be even more of a threat to myself
that,
if I would.
That is not true with respect. Mr. Batt intentionally counseled the village of Holland to engage in illegal conduct that was stipulated, that was submitted on the record before the Bar Association. He knew what he was telling the village of Holland to do in the liquor matter. It was illegal, even unconstitutional under the state of Ohio. Going into partnership with the village and running a bar. He very carefully and intentionally crafted an affidavit that he had the clerk of the village of Collins sign. The affidavit led the Liquor Control Commission to believe that he had $10,000. Only a lawyer skilled in municipal finance would have understood that there was not $10,000 there. Mr. Batt is very, very smart, and a lot of what he has done is very deceitful. And that has continued, I must say, in his arguments before the panel and in his arguments today. Where is the deceit? You heard one instance of it mentioned in Mr.
about theft in office. I mean, I know he's already paid the criminal penalty for that, but I mean, that would carry over into any sort of practice if someone is dishonest.
That's the problem we have, and that's why we think we need a very firm, strong message to Mr. Babb, that there should be no retroactivity at the very least. Now, on the you have to read the record of the hearing before Judge McDonald on the consideration of the sentence and release from probation. Very clearly, if you read that record, Judge McDonald was under the impression that Mr. Babb had lost his license to practice permanently. This hearing occurred 18 months after the stipulation where we agreed to recommend permanent disbarment.
Yeah.
So that was not a foregone conclusion at that time. There was no disclosure of the stipulation to Judge McDonald at all. Judge McDonald concludes.
Your original recommendation was permanent disbarment. It was only
indefinite suspension.
Oh, you just said permanent disbarment.
I misspoke.
Yeah. He meant indefinite.
Judge McDonald believed that he had been permanently disbarred. We have recommended indefinite suspension. And that stipulation had been in effect for 18 months when that hearing occurred. Mr. Babb did nothing to disabuse Judge McDonald of that notion. No one else was present to do anything different. Judge McDonald didn't have a clue to the stipulation that ever ended. Nobody did. Now, this on the restitution issue. It's not quite as simple as Mr. Kevlar says. Mr. Babb stated in person to the hearing panel, as far as quantifying and quantifying the amount of the overdone, Judge McDonald quantified it in his order of restitution. Judge McDonald quantified it. And as is shown in my statement, Mr. Babb's statement was paid. Mr. Babb again stated in his brief before the hearing panel before this court, he has made full restitution as ordered by the court. Judge McDonald quantified the amount of restitution on the improper billing and it has been paid. Fact. Judge McDonald did not quantify full restitution. He went to great lengths to state he was not quantifying full restitution. He said that he was determining restitution only with respect to the criminal violations before him, that he was not determining it for any other time period, that he was using a higher standard to apply in other proceedings, he was using the criminal standard, and that higher standard would not therefore foreclosed the victims from prosecuting claims for overbilling. He recognized that the city of Oregon had additional claims for Oregon for overbilling. He said they're not before me. I'm not deciding that. So Judge McDonald did not quantify overbilling. Oregon did have additional claims for restitution. They lapsed. Nothing's happened with them. The reason Oregon did not pursue them, Mr. Babb was going to bankruptcy, cost money to chase someone to bankruptcy, they weren't going to spend the money to chase him and get nothing in return. It's that simple. That was the city of Oregon's decision. The village of Holland is slightly more complicated, and what you have to look to is the negotiations that occurred. The village of Holland found out a lot of this stuff after the fact of what had been represented by Judge McDonald. Judge McDonald got the settlement agreement, so no background. The village of Holland pursued a malpractice and overbilling claim against respondents. The carrier declined to cover the overbilling claim. The overbilling claim is the restitution claim. But they agreed to settle the malpractice claim. Any time to settle?
Yeah.
Oh, no. We're not going to settle for that. Give a full release to the overbilling claim. Mr. Babb concurred. He said, if you don't settle, by the way, I'm in bankruptcy proceedings and I'll get both claims discharged, so you better settle. Okay? That, I don't think, is restitution in the sense that we're looking for in this process. The overbilling was not a few isolated incidents. We got the criminal transcript in the record. There is overwhelming evidence that it was widespread overbilling. Unrebutted evidence by the respondent, evidence testimony by his work co-workers, lawyers in the office, his attorneys, secretaries, whatever, short work days, long lunches, you name it, not the improper timekeeping, whatever. What the problem is, and what the respondent is arguing, because what it finally came, he had all sorts of excuses as to why he couldn't audit these records, but what it finally came down to is he never kept time records, number one, and number two, probably didn't do the work. So there's no way to go back and audit and quantify the amount of fulfillments that you have.
Well, he says that, as you know, he says that he was in this sort of a mad dash where he had to come to Columbus for and be here for a day and then come and go back to North and then come back down, and that he sort of lost track of timekeeping, and that's the panel didn't believe that, obviously.
Two of the letters attached to the hearing panel brief that I was alluding to are attorneys in his office that contradict that. He still had short work days, he had plenty of time to do it, he had all the timekeeping practices. None of the other attorneys in the office had any trouble with it. He just didn't keep the time, and at the end of the month, he just came in and added up the bill and went away and filled out and covered his expenses for the next month. The only way that this came about is the Village of Holland and the City of Oregon prepared their bills. Well, as soon as that started happening, Mr. Back stopped giving itemized bills to the Village of Holland. So we only have a brief period of about a year where there's any sort of double check on the billing. So what he says in his brief that these records were examined for maintenance.
You can finish your sentence if you'd like.
So he says in his brief that the records were examined from the billing records from 1980 to 1989. It was only for about a year, year and a half that the examination occurred, and it was only by comparing the bills for the two cities. There's no other records on the audit.
Thank you, Mr. McKay. Mr. Kettlewell, you've used your time. It'd take 30 seconds. Submitted, you'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.